They ate their formal dinner at the Four Seasons. Catelyn savored the startled look on the face of the maitre d' as he realized that the party was, in fact, three ladies and two gentlemen. Paying more for that single meal than any other full day's worth of food in the entire trip, and not regretting it a jot. Then they went back to the Imperial Tower, turned in their tuxes, Uchna got to keep the shirt, packed their bags and turned in early. Next day they bade a fond and wistful adieu to the city of Toronto, and headed back around the heel of Lake Ontario toward Niagara Falls. They didn't stop long in Niagara itself. The city was rather dirty, rather tacky, and didn't smell all that good. The falls themselves were spectacular, worth the half-hour they all spent on the observation platform and taking the tour of the tunnels that led behind the cataract. But they felt no desire to linger in the area once they'd seen the only attraction, and so they crossed back into the United States without incident and motored east. As they did, they talked about this and that, reliving their experiences. Catelyn, Dorothy, and Miki talked about their meeting with Joe Groff and his Torontonian guitar band. Uchna and Sayanji told the stories of their hockey experience with Roy Chernov in more coherent, less you-had-to-have-just-been-there terms. Joe said he'd come to our show on the 26th, said Kate cheerfully. I might try to get him to join us for a cover. Something classic and guitar-y. Purple Haze, maybe. Azalyn doesn't like playing that one. Says it makes her teeth hurt. Purple Haze, isn't that the Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy song? Asked Uchna. It's Kiss the Sky, said Catelyn, rolling her eyes. Uchna smiled. Yeah, I know, but you might want to change it. Kate blinked at her, then snorted. Please. Can't I think a guy is cool without everybody assumes I'm hot for him? Besides, she added pontifically, older guys are trouble. Tell me about it, said Uchna wryly. Kate gave her an alarmed look, as if she hadn't realized she was heading that way, but Uchna waved it off. It was a beautiful sunny afternoon, the snow was gone, the climate field was working perfectly, and it hardly seemed out of place at all for Vivaldi's Spring to be pouring from Vlad the Impala's stereo. Under conditions like this, she could shrug it off, and did so. Are you really going to put that picture of Tenjo and me in the yearbook? Asked Sayanji in a slightly pained tone. Of course. I won the duel. I can do whatever I want with it, Kate replied airily. I will get you for that, you realize, said Uchna with a smile. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday you will pay. Kate smiled. I know, she replied. They reached WPI in the early evening, and were promptly ambushed by Azalyn, who nearly knocked down each of them in turn as she greeted them in front of the wedge. How was it? She asked. Did you have a good time? Devlin and Amanda are back. Already? Asked Kate, puzzled. Yeah, said Azalyn, looking a little upset. It, didn't go all that well. Amanda's father didn't like Devlin? Miki asked. Oh no, that went fine. It's just that her sister spent the whole week trying to kill her, and, well, I'll let her tell you. She's in the wedge. They sat in the wedge with Azalyn, Mia, Amanda, and Devlin, hearing the latter two's stories of their eventful week on Gamelon, telling stories of Toronto to cheer them up in return. One of the stories of the week on Gamelon didn't have to be told. It was plain to see in the modifications to Amanda's face, which had drawn a wide range of alarmed exclamations from the road trippers upon seeing them. The scar crossing her right eye was startling, the cybernetic cowl sealing off that eye socket more so, but Amanda seemed quite philosophical about it. It didn't escape any of the five, in fact, that Amanda and Devlin's shared experiences, arduous as they were, had brought them closer together. They sat next to each other in the corner of the big wedge booth the whole time, trading glances, their hands linked. Amanda was never much on public displays of affection. For her to hold Devlin's hand in a common area like the wedge was akin, as Azalyn put it later, to a normal girl slobbering in his ear on a city bus. The discussion only briefly touched on the passage of the extension to the Psi Act. After all, though it boded ill for the structure of society at large, it would have no direct effect on any of them, right? For once in her life, Azalyn Devere Natoshkin missed a trick. Jury Arisugua glanced up from the book she was reading as Dorothy let herself into Morgan 413 and smiled. "Hello," she said. "How was your trip?" "Quite entertaining," Dorothy replied, plunking her suitcase down on her bed. "How was your week?" "Quiet," Jury replied. "I've enrolled in a class next term," she added after a moment. "Oh?" Dorothy said as she began unpacking and hanging up her clothes.
"Just one?"
"For now. I only wanted to be enrolled so that my presence here would be legitimate, and to test the waters a bit. I tested in as a junior, but I don't feel taking on a full course load just now would be advisable. So I'll take one class to get my hand in, and perhaps next year, when you're all juniors too, I'll jump back in full time."
"Probably wise," Dorothy agreed. "What class?"
20th Century Literature 3. "Devlin Carter and I are taking that next term as well. Which division are you in?"
1, Professor Harris's."
"Oh, that's too bad. Devlin and I will be in Division 2 with Professor Chandrajan." She turned and gave her roommate a faint smile. "Chances are you'll be thrown out of Division 1 within a week, so I expect we'll be able to study together anyway."
"Well, we'll see," Jury replied with a matching little smile.
Janice, the RA, leaned in at the door. "Hey, you're back," she said to Dorothy. "Have fun up north?"
"Yes," Dorothy replied. "It was illuminating."
"Well, good. I'm glad you're back. The redhead's done nothing but pace all week," said Janice, indicating Jury. "Keeps me up at night."
"Sorry," said Jury dryly, smiling slightly over the top of her book.
Next morning at breakfast, Caitlin mentioned the conference she'd been invited to and, very hesitantly, asked Jury if she would like to be her guest in Paris. Jury received the invitation with calm, almost impassion, and asked, "What would I do while you're at the conference?"
"Oh, there's plenty to do in Paris," said Azeline brightly from across the table. "Museums and churches and historic places and shops and more museums, and you could spend a month there and not scratch the surface of all there is to do. I went there for a term last year to do a project for my hyperlinguistics French unit, and it was the most fun I've ever had. It's such a beautiful city. And so romantic, too," she added, smiling a little dreamily. "Excusez-moi, monsieur. Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?"
Jury blinked. "Excuse me, sir, would you like to go to bed with me tonight?" Azeline grinned.
"Ah, you speak French. That'll help."
"That was Gaulish," Jury said. It was Azeline's turn to blink at her.
"The language of Gaulia back home," Jury elaborated. "It's the heartland of international fencing in Sephiro. I learned the language when I was a girl so that I could study under one of the great Gallic fencing masters, Charbonneau. He refused to take any student who wasn't fluent in Gaulish."
"Well, isn't that a coincidence?" said Azeline. "Here on Earth it's French, the language of France, which is the country where Paris is. So you're all set."
Jury looked somewhere between faintly troubled and faintly amused, then turned to Caitlin.
"As it happens, I have enrolled it for a class in D-term," she said, "but only a single one. I'll speak to my professor and see if I can safely miss the first week, and if so, I'd be happy to accompany you. I'd like to see more of this strange world I've found myself in, and now I'm intrigued. I wonder how much like Gallia this France will turn out to be."
Caitlin smiled. "Well," she said, I'll be glad to have you, if you can come.
For some reason, she seemed to think that was a slightly embarrassing thing to say after she'd said it. Going a little pink, she busied herself with her alleged waffles. Azeline diplomatically failed to notice. Jury just plain failed. Corwin arrived at noon, all smiles. Utina, who had spent the morning doing laundry and hurriedly repacking, met him in the wedge, where he'd already found Kate and started looking at the photos from Toronto. As had Utina and Sayanji at the sight of the real thing, he nearly laughed himself unconscious at the picture of Goth Miki.
"Well," he said after he'd reassembled himself and seen the rest of the photos, "we'd better get going. Aunt Belle's expecting us for dinner, and she doesn't like it when people are late."
"Does she get mad? I can't really even picture your aunt mad."
"No," Corwin said. "Worse. She gets disappointed."
"Oh," said Utina, nodding. "I gotcha.
Yeah, we'd better get moving."
She She leaned down to pick up her bag and asked Caitlin one last time, "You sure you're going to be okay?" Kate gave her a smile and a nod. This was going to be the first night since 2 days before Christmas that Caitlin had slept alone. She and Utina had gone back to their separate bunks upon returning to school, but not since December 22nd had she been alone in a bedroom for a night. Utina's concern was not misplaced, but, Kate thought, it wasn't necessary.
"I'll be fine," she replied quietly. "Thanks for asking."
"If you find out you were wrong," Utina murmured, "call. Corwin was there. He'll understand." Kate nodded again.
"I know. Go on. Have a good time."
"Okay." Utina put her hand on her roommate's shoulder, gave it a gentle squeeze, then hefted her duffel bag and slung it over her shoulder as she straightened. "All righty," she said to Corwin with a grin. "Let's go. See you Saturday, Kate."
"See you. Be careful.
"We will," Corwin and Utina said in entertaining stereo. And then they left the wedge, climbed into Corwin's old limo, and roared off to the spaceport. "Did Professor Harris let you out of the first week?" Dorothy asked, looking up from her reading as Jury returned to Morgan 413 that night.
"In a manner of speaking," said Jury dryly as she took off her shoes. "He told me that if I couldn't be bothered to turn up for the first week, I might consider burdening some other professor's class roster with my uncommitted presence, as he himself had no room in his for dilettantes." She sat down on the edge of her bed and stretched.
"So," she went on, "it appears that when Caitlin and I return from Paris, you and I will be classmates after all. Professor Chandrigan was considerably more accommodating."
Dorothy nodded.
"He tends to be." She considered for a moment, then said, "I'm glad you're going. I think you and Caitlin will make good friends."
Jury raised an eyebrow.
"You're starting to sound like Azalin," she said dryly.
Dorothy shrugged slightly. "I probably meant it differently than she would have," she said.
Jury smiled.
"Probably.
Either way, I..."
"What's that?" she interrupted herself, as Dorothy pinned a photo to the corkboard on the wall behind her desk.
Jury got up and crossed the room to take a closer look at it. It was a photo of a slim, pale young man dressed in an outlandish getup of black velvet and white ruffled silk, with streaks of kohl surrounding his eyes, black lipstick, and white face powder enhancing his pallor beneath them. His hair was bluish-black and spiked into a cleverly geometric disorder. He stood with his right hand in the pocket of his velvet smoking jacket. His left hand was raised, palm up, and a goblet of some blood-red liquid rested in it, the liquid matching the scarlet polish on his fingernails. His fingers were bedecked with rings, his bare chest crossed by black beads in a silver ankh. One blue eyebrow was cocked above one black-rimmed blue eye, the expression on his handsome, powdered, painted face an intriguing combination of ennui, amusement, and frank, slightly mocking sexual challenge. Jury wasn't one to have her head turned by a picture of a man, especially one she didn't know, but there was something very interesting indeed about this weirdly dressed stranger. For all his outlandish garb and peculiar makeup, he had a curious magnetism about him. The look in his eyes, the faint and mocking smile on his black-painted lips, made it hard to look away from him. In person, she thought, the effect might well have been palpable.
"Who on earth?" Jury wondered before the lines of his face sank in.
She gave a disbelieving little cry and leaned closer.
"Is that Mickey?" she asked.
Dorothy smiled. "Yes," she replied. "He protested the costume at first, but by the end of the evening he'd started to get into it, as you can see."
Jury blinked at the picture in disbelief. She didn't laugh. She was the first person Dorothy had seen looking at it who hadn't laughed.
Dorothy found that quite interesting, but didn't comment.
"Were you all dressed like that?" Jury inquired after a few silent moments of gazing at the picture of Mickey.
"No," said Dorothy. "Only Mickey, Caitlin, and me." She shuffled through the stack of copies Kate had given her and sorted out the pictures of herself and Kate. Jury looked them over, smiling now.
"Interesting style," she said. "Where on earth did you go that you had to dress like that?"
"Sneaky D's," said Dorothy. "We didn't have to dress that way. We did it for fun."
"My goodness," said Jury, shaking her head. I may never look at poor Mickey the same way again. The week passed uneventfully for those who stayed in Worcester. Caitlin received nightly phone updates from Utina, who assured her that her motorist training was going very well indeed. She was getting a crash course, no pun intended, from Corwin, his mother, and his uncle Keiichi, the last of whom was a mechanical engineering professor at the Nekomi Institute of Technology on Tomodachi, and a famous racing driver in certain circles on that populous, racing-crazy planet. By the end of the week, Uncle Keiichi assured Kate the three of them would have Utina ready to run the Paris to Dakar rally if she felt like it. That might have been a slight exaggeration, but she certainly seemed to be having fun anyway. Kate spent the week brushing up on her Gaulish, French, arranging the things she would need to take with her, and finalizing the selection of the compositions she would take with her to represent her year's efforts before her peers at the IRCAM Conference of Modern Composers. The portfolio she selected, with Miki's assistance and Jury's tasteful advice, she thought well-balanced, including several of her new classical-style pieces, Pride of Place going to the composition Miki had helped her perfect on Christmas, a neo-swing piece for big band, and two new Art of Noise songs. On Saturday, Utina returned, flushed with success and slightly sunburned from bombing around Nekomikoka in an open car for most of the week. She had her new Avalon driver's license and an honorary membership in the NIT Motor Club for her week's efforts, and Corwin was so proud of her accomplishments under his tutelage that he looked as if he might explode. She spent Saturday night regaling the nearly full membership of the Duelist Society, and a few others, with stories of the hair-raising near-misses, close shaves, and outright wrecks she, Corwin, Skold, and or Keiichi had been involved in, with occasional digressions into Aunt Belle's fussing over their minor injuries and mechanical problems. Her first meeting with Corwin's other aunt, Urd, had apparently gone quite well too, but nobody could get any details. Saturday morning, Kate rose early, dressed, gathered up her bags, said her goodbyes to Utina, and went across the hall to see that Jury was ready to go. She was, and after taking her leave of Dorothy, she accompanied Kate down to Vlad the Impala. Thanks for coming, said Kate as she drove toward Boston. It's really kind of a bummer being all alone in Paris. Jury smiled, slightly, but smiled all the same. I'm looking forward to it, she said. It'll be a chance for us to get to know each other better. Her smile became slightly wry as she added in a familiar deadpan tone, I'm trying to be a more social creature. Caitlin glanced at her as if she didn't quite know how to interpret that. Then she smiled, sat back in her seat a little, and began to laugh. After a moment, Jury joined her. Avery Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 1, On Tract, Hogtown Rhapsody. The cast, in order of appearance. Utina Tenjo, Caitlin Hutchins, Miki Kaworu, R. Dorothy Wainwright, Kyuichi Sionji, Nick Rivers, Juan Homin, Dimitrios Makenikos Arbuthnot, Jeff Campbell, Dios, Corwin Ravenhair, Skald Ravenhair, Roy Chernov, the 2404-2405 Toronto Maple Leafs, the 2404-2405 Ottawa Senators, Domina Kelly, Jill McElwain, Joe Groff, Eric Arnolfson, Jay Chen, Denise Howarth, the Crunch and Munch Vendor, Frank Deverick, Azalin Devere-Natoshkin, Mia Ausa, Amanda Electra Dessler, Devlin Carter, Jury Arisugawa, Janice Barlow. Framer of Worlds, Benjamin D. Hutchins. Ice Hockey Rules Lawyer, John Trussell. Mr. Kaworu's Wardrobe by Anne Cross. Typo Catchers, The Usual Suspects. Joe Groff and The Crush of Love, musically inspired by Joe Satriani and his live tour band, Eric Codier, Stuart Hamm, and Jeff Campitelli. Victorian Porn, excerpted from Erotic Tales of the Victorian Age, Editor Anonymous, by way of www.ralphmag.com/briefsv.html, which seems to be a bunch of book reviews. Canadian late night cable really does have dramatic readings of Victorian porn. We've forgotten the name of the show, but the pimp opera is quoted from memory of an actual Toronto late night cable comedy show
circa September 2000. The Crunch and Munch guy is real. As of early 1999, he worked at the Fleet Center. Volcano line snagged from a random late-night documentary. I didn't want to forget it, so I put it in here. The symphony will return. Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ben Hutchins.